everyone, and welcome to the Catalyst Stories podcast. I'm John Hino, your host for today's episode. And today, I'm so blessed to have Liz Komai on the podcast. Now, Liz is part of the marketing department for an international financial organization. At Catalyst, Liz is involved in worship teams along with her sister Marcy and mom Catherine, and sometimes even her niece Mimi as well. Liz has three children, daughter Evelyn, who's in college, son Brandon, who's in high school, and daughter Vivian, who's a middle schooler. And so with that, Liz, welcome to Catalyst Stories.
Hey, thanks. I'm very excited to be here. It's my first podcast.
I know. Well, it's such a blessing to have you. And so now and in the past, we have had families serving on worship teams together here at Catalyst, which I think is such a blessing to see. And so I thought I'd start off by asking you what it's like for you to be involved in worship teams with really your whole family.
Yeah, it's definitely from my adult perspective, it's a huge blessing because I can see the generational just beauty of it.
Yes, yes.
And kind of similarly to what you might hear in other people's lives that have grown up in the church and might be in a music industry of any type, just all that time spent in the church. My parents both served on worship teams. My dad played the guitar and did vocals, and my mom was vocals as well. So I kind of grew up that way, and that was my earliest probably introduction to regular music and singing and just learning just that kind of community of singing together and then eventually singing on a team and helping out with that. That's something that I definitely personally really enjoy. So it's really cool to watch my younger sister grow up into this kind of amazing worship leader that she is.
Yes.
And there's a lot more to being a worship leader than just being able to sing or going up there. It's a lot of skill that I respect, that I see in her. And all worship leaders are different and they have different types of skills, but
Well, it's a blessing to not only see you together with your sister Marcy, but to hear you guys as well, because I think you blend really well together. So that's an added blessing.
Sure, I just give that credit to the genetics, I mean.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I was telling you, too, that I remember when I was back in college, going to some Bible studies at your parents' house, and hearing your dad lead worship and your mom getting prophetic words. And so, and I remember you, a small you and a small Marcy, sometimes joining the group as well. So it's awesome to see that their influence seemed to be real strong with you both, huh?
Yeah. I love that. I mean, I definitely have strong memories of what my dad with a guitar and my parents just together leading different groups, whether it was small, intimate, fireside, fire pit situations or the larger aspects as well.
Definitely. And I think, like you said, it is awesome to see the generational blessing, you know, the legacy passed on from your parents, and then now, you know, your mom can be part of the worship teams, you and Marcy, and then, you know, even your niece and your niece as well. So that is so awesome to see. Yeah. Okay. So I thought, now you and Marcy were both preacher's kids, right? PKs. I know your dad was also an elementary school teacher. But I wanted to start by asking you, what was that growing up for you, having your dad as a pastor as well?
So I definitely grew up, we were heavily a part of the faith culture, the faith space, as far as being in the Christian church. I went to church. We never missed a Sunday. We would take family vacations they were more like summer fishing vacations where we'd rent a condo. And they would look for a church out there, wherever we were. And just be visitors at that church. Or my dad would literally open his Bible on Sunday and bring his guitar always and play some songs and read out the Bible. And we'd have just a little mini kind of a Sunday.
Right. So, you were going to have church no matter what, right?
Yeah. And it wasn't harsh. It was just like, you know, this is part of the family rhythm. It kind of wore on me because, you know, it's definitely more of a, I'm part of this culture. I'm not necessarily making these decisions.
Right.
But my family did life like this. And when I became a teenager, when I was actually in junior high, middle school, is when my dad became a youth pastor. So they'd always been involved in ministry. There were a lot of nights that they would spend, or like you mentioned, groups of folks that would come over to our house to kind of engage in various things. So I grew up definitely seeing it constantly, regardless of whatever my dad was doing for full-time work on the side. And it was cool. It definitely gives you a very kind of heightened sense of being comfortable and being able to observe a lot and engage with a lot of different aspects of what it means to be part of a ministry or operating in your faith, but also just the logistics and practicalities and ins and outs of all the interactions and planning that go on.
Yes.
And then at some point, as a teenager, I started to just really want to know who God was myself. And, you know, I remember thinking in my head, would I still believe in God if I weren't raised this way? Or if my family weren't Christian? And if none of my friends were Christian, how would I feel about God? So that was like a kind of a key moment where I had to take it seriously and try to figure it out.
So what do you attribute then to your coming into the faith? Because it sounds like they were very your parents were very instrumental in you coming to know the Lord.
Yeah, so for the entirety of my life, I have a pretty long memory. some people have big gaps of I don't remember that part of my life, but I remember probably marking back to maybe kindergarten because I remember teachers and I remember classmates.
Yeah.
But my parents were always really, really, really consistent.
Yes.
And although in everybody's kind of relationship, they kind of may have different moments of being closer or farther away from whatever engagement they have.
Yeah.
They were always engaged.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it felt authentic. It didn't feel forced. It didn't feel like they were doing it for any other reason than because they thought it was important for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was important to me because when you're around a lot of people engage, you see all different levels of motivation. Mm-hmm. And the one that always bothered me was guilt, shame, fear, any of those. I don't know that I recognized it in that way when I was young, but definitely the older I got, the more I started to see that, those are the places where it rubs me the wrong way. And I know that God will use all things to kind of bring people into that space closer to him. But so I always felt like my parents set a really strong, consistent example.
And I think you even told me that I think they even had you memorizing scriptures too, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I mean, I feel like that's kind of built in just to Sunday school where they kind of expose you to things and encourage you to learn some verses. And I know that I remember watching my mom with her Bible every morning, every morning with a notebook, the Bible, and then eventually the Greek Bible, translating it, or the Hebrew Bible, whichever it was, translating it so she could try to connect in a different way to the Bible that she was familiar with already. And then for my dad, just him memorizing Bible verses and transcribing the references in his tiny little dad print on little lines that he would create columns with a ruler in it, like a ballpoint pen on a 5x7 index card. And in each one of those little spaces, writing like a verse reference and then just kind of going through them. He would invite Marcy and I to, if we were interested, to memorize verses. And I mean, if I'm being honest, my initial response is like, hey, no thanks to memorizing stuff. But Marcy was a good student and, you know, willing. And so there was a little part of me that felt pushed. I'm like, well, I can't just let myself look like I don't care. So, so it did encourage me, you know, in small ways like that. But to this day, there are verses that pop up, and I remember them as being verses that I learned with my dad.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, just based on what you said, I feel like that's an encouragement for us as parents, because sometimes we think, gosh, do the things that we say to our kids actually stick? And I think, you know, you're a living example that, yeah, you know, even though they might seem rebellious, yep. they're listening, huh? And there are things that they're retaining, huh?
Yep. Those seeds, those foundations are there, and they might look different than what you intended, but
yeah,
for sure.
So, you know, you were talking about your dad, and I wondered if you can talk about him as a person, what he was like, because I know that, you were telling me he used to pick you up and drop you off at UCLA for school, and you guys had some good talks. And so tell me about your dad.
Yeah. So it's really interesting because, you know, you revisit these memories. My dad passed away when I was 22, and I've had time and different stages of my life where I was a young adult and then a married adult and then had kids of my own and now have a kid in college. So at all these different phases, I kind of rethink, oh, this is how old my dad was when I was in college or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it just pieces together really differently. But and then the older I get to, the more nuance I gain as to the type of person he was or why he might have done. And people will give me little bits and pieces of their memory, so that kind of helps fill out my impressions. But basically, my dad was somebody that I felt very safe with. I felt like I could be affectionate. I'm a physical touch person, but it's very specific. Like, I don't necessarily go out hugging people. It's more of like a very personal, private thing. But when somebody is in that very inner circle, for me to feel comfortable, like climbing on my dad or going to him or bothering him, you know, even just like messing around, I always felt very comfortable.
Yeah.
And he always seemed to welcome it and not just, you know, like tolerating. So that's something I kind of took for granted, I guess, when I was a kid. And then he was, for me, very reliable. Like if I needed something, I recognized that at that point in our life, financially, we were a little limited, but as far as, him being willing to give me a ride somewhere, if I needed to go to a friend's house or to even beyond myself, even to picking up all of my friends, like five or six girls, and bringing us all, to youth group in Gardena, which is not close. It was like, I mean, I don't know how many hours that took. I mean, we all lived kind of in a tight radius in within a certain space, but you had to go to each house, wait for the girl to come out, get in the car, and then pick up another girl, and then drive us all into Gardena to go to youth group, and then take us all home and drop us off one by one.
Right.
And he did that every week.
Right.
And sometimes on Sundays too. And then eventually one of my old school teachers and her husband, who also attended our church, the Hiroshigas, Ken and Judy, they offered to kind of take the girls home, take us home just to kind of, you know,
help out.
And then the same for, as you mentioned, in college, I have a daughter at UCSD. I'm in Orange County. And so it's within reasonable distance, but it's still like a 3-hour turnaround.
Yeah.
And, for us, I went to UCLA, and that traffic is basically the same.
Oh, yeah.
So now that I think about it, the fact that he picked me up every Friday and made that 3-hour round trip, and then every Sunday taking me back until I got to the point where I had my own car.
Yeah.
And sometimes my friends, sometimes he'd scoop up some of my friends who lived in the South Bay and drop them off too.
Yeah.
That's a lot. And he never looked annoyed or put out. He never, in my memory, I don't remember him ever giving me a hard time or me ever feeling bad. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember and still remember the 405 and the 10 and the 10 freeway. And so I absolutely know how
still
chaotic
terrible.
That place can get. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, you have all this time as he picks you up and you're coming back. You remember any of the things that you talked about?
So what I want to say is it was probably mostly me talking because I have a lot of thoughts and, you know, I can
And your dad has a great ear.
But I don't remember him being silent, though. I don't remember him just being silent. So he would say things at some point. So it didn't feel like just me monologuing the whole time. But it felt good to me. I felt comfortable sharing whatever was kind of in there, whatever was going on, and that he was going to listen. I don't necessarily remember him being quick to offer advice or push any sort of, you know, thoughts on me. But I just know that I felt like he was listening.
Yeah.
And that he would give me his thoughts. As they came along.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, your dad, who was also an elementary school teacher, went through a rough period back in 1988. And so I wondered if you can talk about that time, because I know it was hard for all of you also as a family too, huh?
Yeah. So my memories are very specific to me being probably in like seventh or eighth grade.
Okay.
So my memories are coming from like a pretty young place.
Yeah.
But my understanding, well, what I remember clearly is coming home from school, I had my backpack on, and we might have even gotten picked up, which is rare. Usually we'd just take the bus. Not exactly sure if they picked us up from the bus stop or however, but it was a little different than our normal routine, and came in the house, and I think I remember my mom being on the phone that was attached to the wall with a long cord, and just being very kind of in some sort of serious conversation, looking a little bit stressed out. And then she just had us sit on the couch. And then my sister and I were both sitting there with our backpacks on, kind of like, what is going on? Because something's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when she got off the phone, she said, you know, I need to talk to you girls about something. And basically what we learned was that our dad, our lovely, lovely father, had been arrested and had been accused, of hurting kids. And that was just so shocking, because I mean, the man was amazing with all kids and nothing but loving, and animals, kids and animals. Mm-hmm. Like that's the guy that if you're going to leave your kid or your dog with anybody, it's going to be him. And so I was just kind of like, what are you talking about? Like, again, I'm a preteen at this point. And it was scary, because I'm like, so what does this mean? And, you know, so I'm processing it in my head. And,
sure.
And they're just trying to give us some information without giving us too much information. Like, well, you know, there's lawyers. You know, we have a lawyer. Anyway, whatever the adult bits of the business were, they kind of gave us a simplified version. And then just to prepare us, they said, well, they're probably going to send a social worker to come visit you and your sister at your separate schools. And, you know, don't be afraid. Just answer whatever questions they may have. And then we'll see what happens. Because nobody knew. Nobody knew what was going to happen next.
Right.
And so that was just shocking. And I just felt confused and shocked and bewildered. Like, how could this even be possible, happening?
Right.
To that guy. And what does this mean? And, you know, what are we supposed to do? And just a lot of questions that I had unanswered. Right.
And I think you even told me the timing in which this happened was unusual too, because at that time, I think you had said he was up for being a youth pastor at Gardena Valley Baptist Church, or was it?
My memory. Again, the chronology might be a little off, because I was probably 11 or 12 at the time.
Sure,
but as far as I understood, he was looking into potentially changing careers from teaching elementary school into being a youth pastor. And I was vaguely aware of that. And so I was just, it was a really interesting time, very confusing for me. And then clearly stressful, as I could see, for everybody around me.
Right.
You know, I had no idea of like what it felt like to be my mom or my dad in that situation. I'm like, he's in jail right now? Like, what kind of jail? You know, I mean, you just have all these questions. And and then, is he okay? Like, he's probably scared or afraid, or whoever knows, like, what his feelings were. And if I felt the way I felt, I could only imagine, you know, like, how terrible he might be feeling, you know, as well as my mom or family members or my grandparents.
Right.
It was an awful situation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time even thinking about the kids and their parents. Regardless of whatever the reasons were, I knew that as a parent, and if your child shares something with you of that nature, like you have to process it and consider, like, is it true or is it not true?
Right.
And if it is true, like, there's so many things to address. And so to this day, I wonder about them and some of the impact that had, regardless of whether it happened or not. Just, they might still believe it to this day. And that makes me really sad.
Right. And I know during this whole time too, you had kind of a freak accident. And I wondered if you can talk about that, because that the timing in that was so unusual as well, right?
Right. So we had been given the heads up that a social worker would come to visit. That's just kind of normal part of procedure for this type of situation.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I was just in my room kind of tidying up. I was standing on top of my bed. There was a chair. My desk chair was against my bed with the back of the chair touching the bed. And normally I would just hop down off the top of the bed to the ground. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, I stepped over the back of the chair and I stepped too far to the front of the seat and tipped the chair. And I was probably within, like, I don't know, 18 inches of the wall. Mm-hmm. And so I unexpectedly tipped the chair, lost my balance, and basically slammed my full body weight against the wall.
Yeah.
And so I bit into my lip really hard. So I felt blood running down my face. I ran to the bathroom. I'm like, okay, great. So I've got a deep bite mark in my lip. It's bleeding. I can see whatever side of my body hit the wall first. I can't remember if it was my left or my right, but I could see purpling already on my cheekbone.
Wow.
And then later I found, you know, like bruising on my shoulder and my hip where those parts of my body made impact as well. And I was like, oh, fantastic. And so the social worker is going to show up and then I'm going to say, oh yeah, I slammed myself against the wall. And that's going to sound totally believable and realistic. So great. And my mom kind of came in to check on me, and she was just like, oh no, you know, you know, this is not good timing for this, you know? Yeah. And then she just kind of helped clean me up and stuff. So that happened on a Friday, and I had the weekend to kind of hope.
Heal up, huh?
Like ice it. I don't know. I was just mean, I'm 11 or 12 or however old, so.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, okay, the body stuff I can cover with my clothes, that's fine. I'm not like moving poorly or anything like that. But the face stuff, it's a little bit harder to shield, especially the lip because it was damaged. So I remember putting some, I probably didn't even use the right level of foundation, but I remember trying to cover up some of the color on my face, on my cheekbone, and then the lip had gone down, but it was still, you know, a little bit beat up. And I remember, I don't know if it was lunch or one of my classes, but sure enough, this is Monday, and I got a note from the office and saying, hey, you know, there's somebody here to see you in the office. So I knew it was a social worker. So I was like, fantastic. I was like, okay, God, we both know that this is totally my fault. It has nothing to do with my dad or the situation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just, you know, help me. That's all I could do. And I remember talking to the social worker and propping my chin on my hand and using my fingers to cover my cheekbone as best as I could. I'm like, I hope this seems natural to her.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't want her. It probably drew more attention, if anything, but she seemed fine. And I guess my answers, I mean, I was like, I'm probably nervous, but I'm nervous about my face and not because of the questions, you know, she's asking me. So I hope that I read correctly to her, that I don't read like an abused child or something.
Right, right.
And so it seems like nothing came out of that. Because in my head, I was like, if she doesn't believe me, then they'll take us away from my parents. Or I didn't know. I didn't know what could happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm like, I don't want this to be negatively impacting to my family.
Yeah.
So it was scary, but it turned out, I think it turned out fine because I didn't see anything come out of that.
Yeah.
That was very relieving.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And I love how this story has a great ending to it. So I wondered if you can talk about what finally happened with your dad's case. And
yeah. So again, my limited understanding as a child at that time, but I believe the case went on for about a year. This is, you know, pre the internet, so there's no records for me to be able to find to this day. If I were to try to look it up, so I could only ask, and none of the adults were really updating us very often mm-hmm. as to like what was happening, but I just know they were in court
yeah.
all the time, and letters were written by trusted members of the community, a lot of character witness in a positive way, including mm-hmm. other students and staff, other people in that had been close at hand to say, this is a good man, mm-hmm. and to stand, mm-hmm. kind of speak for him. And at the end of it, he was acquitted of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't fully know all the details, but as my understanding that, you know, one charge of whatever, that they had made a list of all the things that allegedly had been spoken of, and one charge was something like 3 years, or at the time, whatever the kind of situation was, and it was going to be like multiple life sentences worth if these things are true, and so, mm-hmm. And I knew they weren't true,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't understand how neutral people in the court system would be able to believe uh-huh. it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have mm-hmm. to prove that he did them without beyond a shadow of the doubt to a jury or whomever. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure mm-hmm. how the case was set up, but mm-hmm. so maybe that was an issue. But just in my heart to know that there are people out there believing that he did something
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
destructive.
Right.
You know,
right.
that still, to this day, as I mentioned, it still bothers me, you know. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. the fact that he was fully acquitted, and that the community stood behind him, and that he yeah. was able to become a youth pastor.
Yes.
That's
yes,
huge.
That's huge.
And yeah. as an adult, when I process that, I'm yeah. like, that's huge. Because you don't, even if you didn't, you personally didn't believe somebody did that, to install them into a position of
yeah.
having responsibility and authority over children with that known to the public,
mm-hmm.
that's a right. huge, huge kind of a yeah. situation to deal with. And
yeah.
so I'm yeah. super thankful that the results turned out that way, and just God kind of redeeming the situation.
Yes, yes.
Not just for me and for my parents, but also for the family and other people in our lives.
Yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as I was reflecting on your story, Psalm 17:2 came to mind. So I just wanted to read that. Let my vindication come from you. May your eyes see what is right. And I just feel like in the case of your dad, that like you said, he was vindicated. Mm-hmm. So that's so awesome. Now, eventually, you lost your dad. And so I wondered, I know it's probably tough to talk about it, but I wondered to see if you can talk about what had happened.
Sure. So again, a very specific moment in time captured. My yeah. sister and I had gotten together to go watch a movie. It was 50 First Dates. And I had a pager at the time, mm-hmm. and I got this pager message from my mom, probably. And that was a little bit unusual. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that's weird. So we called, and then we were told that Dad had been taken to the hospital, mm-hmm. and that we needed to come right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so Marcy and I, again, it's another situation where like, oh my gosh, what's going on? So we get in my car and we drive and we meet everybody, and you know, my mom's there with some supportive friends and family, and it turned out. So I'm older now. This is in my 20s.
Okay.
But my understanding, which again may not be entirely accurate, but he had been having some like chest pains, and he was really good about regularly going to the doctor to check on that, to monitor
mm-hmm.
it. He was good at, he was a jogger.
Okay.
He walked the dog, he went to the gym, he liked to play basketball. So he loved food, but he tried to eat healthy things like shredded wheat biscuits with no salt, which I find to be pretty terrible personally, but and you know, just fiber and stuff. I remember him Metamucil, like, you know, this is not an ad for them, but I just remember him, you know, yeah. being conscientious and trying to do make healthy life choices. And so it's a little surprising. So I want to say it's probably more of like a genetic thing,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
he had basically some kind of cardiac episode while in his stick shift minivan at a red light. So he lost consciousness and slumped over the wheel. And because he was at a full stop, the car rolled gently and tapped the car in front of him at the red light. And then when the other drivers noticed that he was down, the story is that there's an off-duty police officer somewhere in that line, and he got out and started administering CPR. They weren't able to resuscitate him, and 911, ambulance had been called, and they weren't able to resuscitate him until much later. So he had been down without an active heartbeat for a good amount of time.
Oh.
And by medical standards, the lack of oxygen to the brain would be significant. The results would be significant at that point. So when my sister and I got to the hospital, they were working on him, and eventually they did get his heart going again, but the prognosis was not very encouraging, you know. And there's just a wide spectrum of what could happen next. We don't know. So based on what we know, there's going to be some potentially serious issues, and they could be any of these things. But sometimes, you know, with different kind of observational treatments or things can change and improve dramatically. You just never know.
Right.
And so it was scary but hopeful. And then I just remember everyone was praying.
Yeah.
So that was another big significant chunk of time in our lives. And you know, he had visitors every day. He had people praying constantly, physically, in person, and remotely, just covering him in prayer and hoping that for a miracle, basically. And then eventually his body deteriorated. So what happened in my limited, I'm not a medical professional, disclaimer, but in my limited experience, he did open his eyes at some point, and so that was very exciting. But as far as I understood and what I witnessed, he never regained the power of speech or didn't seem like he was able to actively communicate. He wasn't able to physically get up and move around. And so over time, just the quality of life and his body started to deteriorate, just from lack of ability to be self-ambulatory and to feed himself or anything like that. So the doctor, toward the very end, you know, having observed him closely and watching just, you know, the status of his heart and all that, just said that his body, he's not doing well. And it's probably more causing him more harm than good at this point to just kind of keep him going. So that was a really difficult decision that had to be made at that point. But for those of us who, you know, knew my dad, he was always active. He was always outside. He was not like a sitting still, you know, even for prayer. He did a lot of prayer meetings, surprisingly, but a lot of prayer walking as well. So, and I know that he had not wanted to end his life kind of in a prone state. You know, I know that he had had a conversation about what he wanted things to look like at that time.
Right.
And so we all did our best to just kind of be supportive of those who are decision makers and just to like respect their feelings and also, you know, honor what my dad would have wanted.
What do you miss about your dad not being around?
Well, like I said, he was a great resource and he was just very consistent. So if I needed something or I needed time or anything, I knew that he would make himself available. And then, so he was a good dad.
And
I saw him being a good uncle to my cousins and to other community members that had children. You know, he loved to just engage and make them laugh or be silly or goofy or whatever. But also to care, you know, like not just like fun uncle stand, but just building into them. And if I think about it, as a youth pastor, he also had a certain level of investment
right,
you know, into their who they were becoming.
Yeah, yeah.
So I miss that for myself, but I also really miss it for my kids. And I appreciate that they have some other people in their lives, you know, like my brother-in-law, Jerry, who build into them. And there have been other people in our community that have just been themselves.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, through different interactions, whether it was volunteering at our church in Ohio or other places.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, you know, like, here's an example of a godly man or a good man even,
mm-hmm. Yes.
or a yes. good father or a good grandfather, anything that was positive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I miss that for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. Okay. Want to move on to marriage now. So we all know how tough marriage can be. And I think it's safe to say that every marriage, you know, has challenges and disagreements and ups and downs over the years. And I know you are no different. So I wondered if you can talk about that challenge for you and what God showed you through those struggles.
Yeah. So, so when I was growing up, I definitely was under the impression that one day I would like to be married and mm-hmm. have children.
Yeah.
And I know that that's not necessarily how everyone feels, but for me, definitely.
Yeah.
I didn't know what that meant. And then, you know, I spent a lot of time observing. I didn't have my own first relationship until my 20s. And yeah, I felt a kind of way about it. I'm like, what's wrong with me? But also trust the Lord. He has a good plan. But you're conflicted. You kind of go back and forth because, you know, you have your own things that you're thinking about, or you watch other people and you're like, oh, that would be nice, or, you know, anyway. So I did eventually get married, and I was 28, so it was a little bit later than what I had thought about. I clearly remember having this memory of walking down on campus with another friend who had been with his girlfriend since high school, and they did get married, you know, at some point, but I was 18, 17 maybe, and we were just kind of projecting, like, 25, that seems old. that's like, what, 7-8 years from now? That's plenty of time to be able to find somebody and get married, right? Like, that's a long time. Yeah, so as 25 came and went, I was like, okay, well, I don't know what's really going on. But I did get married when I was 28, and it was challenging right away. I did end up with somebody who didn't share my faith, although initially I thought that they were supportive. But it's really, really difficult. You can have a lot of great things in common, but as important as faith is for me personally, and knowing that I might be a little stubborn and do my own thing, but I'm gonna come back and loop back around to, like, my relationship with God, mm-hmm. and that's very personally important to me. And then to not be able to fully bring that into my marriage just makes it that much more challenging.
Sure.
Yeah. So other challenging components were I had a new baby right away. Mm-hmm. So that was a big adjustment, although I like babies and I'd spent a lot of time working with children, so I wasn't completely unfamiliar.
Yeah.
And we moved to a new state. I grew up in California, lived here pretty much my whole life, and then he got into a law school in Ohio. So all of a sudden I'm in, my friends are like, where? I said, Ohio. They're like, what's in Ohio? I'm like, I don't know. I guess I'll find out, you know? So I moved away from, you know, my community of support out here. Mm-hmm. I had been heavily engaged with, you know, like, I have a pretty good family community on both sides of my family.
Yeah.
And I have a large network of friends and, you know,
support network.
Huh? Yeah, yeah. So I moved away from all of that. And I'm basically alone in an apartment with a newborn. Mm-hmm. And, her dad was in class all day, just like struggling, trying to process legal stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, thank God that there are people who enjoy that. 'Cause I definitely am not I'm like, this is why we hire other people to read these documents. Yeah. And then, so by the end of the day, he would be just completely drained and not able to really engage with me, whereas I would be at home all day alone with the baby, kind of like going on walks or maybe talking to strangers. And then I was eagerly anticipating him coming home so we could have dinner, and then I could be like, here's all the stuff I did with the baby. And he's like, I have no capacity to process this information. Like, I'm just totally wiped out. And so, yeah, so that was a struggle out there. So we spent 3 years while he was in law school, and then we moved into Cincinnati. And I came into a really good church community there. I drove by it, and it was very nondescript. It just said Crossroads Church. There was no denomination. It was in a big warehouse.
Okay.
I think it used to be, it wasn't a Home Depot, but something like it. It was some kind of tool warehouse that had gone out of business, and they had turned it into a church. And I'm like, oh, that looks vague. Maybe I'll check it out. So I did go in there, and the first service, I was really appreciated just the style of it. It was a contemporary. They're very intentional. Their target audience is 30-year-old men who don't like church. So it was like a group of, I don't know, the story is there's a group of like 12 or 14 of them, just friends. And they're like, how do we get people we care about? How would we get our friends to want to come to church?
Okay.
And so that's kind of where this particular church grew out of. So it was great for me. And I definitely plugged myself in. And they're like, if you want to meet people and build community, join a small group. So I did that. And slowly, you know, one step at a time, I got more and more involved, started volunteering.
And
that's where I built my base of communication. And my marriage kind of struggled. You know, my husband was very busy and just kind of lonely. Mm-hmm. And I had a completely separate community, and I had 3 kids at some point. And so, and it was kind of very similar to that first year of law school. He was like, I'm kind of just all tapped out from work, and I don't have a lot left to give. For me, that was really difficult, because I'm like, I've been doing the kids all day, and
right.
You know, I guess you're welcome to participate in anything you want to, which was usually a no thanks. And then eventually our lives just diverged. And so I had my own thing with the kids, and I picked up a handful of part-time jobs, and then he was doing his thing. And we did come together and engage, but eventually he kind of started getting into other, finding his connections in other ways. And so our marriage ended, but before then, there was a moment where I was sitting in my van before work shift, and God said, I heard, not audibly, but I felt like the thought came in my head, do you want to save your marriage? And so I've been kind of struggling with it for a while. We were married for a total of 13 years. And I did not answer right away, because my honest initial answer was no, because it sucks. You know, I don't want to stay married if it's going to be like this. But then I also know that God is a redemptive God, and that I've seen him do life-changing things. And the amount of healing and reconciliation that can be experienced is exponential. And I'm like, but I know you can do things. And if you're going to heal us and heal our marriage, then yeah, I want that. And he's like, great. So here's what's going to happen. I'm going to need you to work with me on some things. And I was like, okay, I already know I'm not going to like it. But that's how I know it's God. For me, I know it's God, because he always asks me to do something that I definitely don't want to do. So he's like, yeah, so, you know, I want you to partner with me on submission. And I was like, oh, man. I mean, I've always pushed back a little bit with rules and regulations. That's how I've always been. So submitting, I mean, I'm not anti the concept of, you know, submitting in a marriage. It's, I don't find that to be like archaic or anti-feminist. It's just, if your relationship is what it's supposed to be under God. And I do trust God at this point in my life. I'm like, I believe you are a good God. I don't believe you take advantage of me or gaslight me in any way. So I'm good with you. And if I'm with somebody who is going to follow you, then I can submit to that, that system.
Okay.
But in this case, being with somebody who does not engage mm-hmm. and have a close relationship with the Lord. He was asking me to submit regardless. And I was like, okay. And it was a really difficult but good year of him kind of setting these small, mm-hmm. small obedience places for me to say yes to. And I could say no. I didn't feel forced. Nobody else was like telling me I had to do something. Mm-hmm. But in the interest of him gently kind of shepherding me, just being there with me and constantly inviting me to partner with him and not giving me grief if I didn't hit it exactly right. I just felt always invited toward a better thing. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the perspective I had. An example of that is he was more of like a night owl and a gamer, and so he would spend a lot of time, and then he eventually, well, basically ever since we had been in law school, because of his need to study and because we had a newborn on the other end of the spectrum of concentration, mm-hmm. he started sleeping on the couch just so he could get the rest and he needed. And that kind of continued off mm-hmm. and on. Mm-hmm. So I was with a small group at that time, and one of their ongoing questions that was kind of a church-wide thing was, okay, what do you hear God telling you? Or what do you think God's telling you? And what tangible action are you going to take?
Okay.
And so that was just like a point of action, like what you're called to action this week and that you're actually going to do, not like, I'm going to get closer to God. It's like, I'm going to open my Bible once a week or whatever was actually reasonable that you think you could actually do. Mm-hmm. And you just share that. Mm-hmm. And so it was cool because you get to hear other people processing their individual situation. So one week I was like, I feel like, and I knew because I didn't want to do it. I feel like I'm supposed to invite him upstairs to sleep. Not that he was never unwelcome, but just actively opening my mouth to say the words, mm-hmm. are you going to come upstairs tonight? Mm-hmm. And you're welcome too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I knew he would say no, but just for me to take that step of yeah. humility mm-hmm. and put myself out there and invite him every day. And I was like, okay, that's enough. That's already bad enough. I can do that for like the next week or however long. And then simultaneously to the thought coming in my head, one of the members of my group also opened their mouth. And at the same time as God put it in my head, this other person said, and what if he says no? And I'm like, dang it. Then I'm going to sleep downstairs on the couch too. So that kind of commenced a 9-month period of me sleeping downstairs on the couch. So we had like a three-seater and a love seat kind of in an L shape. And every night I would ask him if he wanted to come up and he would say, oh, I'm good. Or no, I have work to do or for whatever the response was. I'd be like, okay. And then I'd pull the love seat. So it was kind of parallel with the big couch. And I would curl up on that thing and go to sleep. And Viv, who was probably like 2 or 3 at the time, she was kind of still co-sleeping with me. So she would sleep between my spinal cord and the back of the couch. And somehow for 9 months, that's how we slept. Mm. And while a variety of responses came from my husband at the time, whether it be resignment or irritation or whatever, I, at the end of that, felt my heart soften. Mm. And I knew that was something that God was doing in me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what he was doing in the other guy.
Yeah.
But I had agreed to kind of submit to that process, and I could feel my heart softening toward our marriage, regardless of what I was getting back.
Yeah.
Which was the whole point.
Wow. Wow. Wow, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. So I wondered now if we can... Fast forwarding to, I think, just the beginning of this year, you made a comment on social media that your family told you that your dad would have been proud of the way that you handled 2022. So I wondered if you can talk about what made it such a challenging year for you and how you felt your dad would have been proud of the way that you dealt with what you went through.
Yeah, so I don't see my extended family that often, but I would say that we keep tabs on each other. Yeah. And we love each other, and when we do get together, I'm pretty open about what's going on. So it's kind of accumulate the culmination rather of a lot of different things going on. So at this point, you know, it's been about 5 years. My marriage came to a close, and we finalized our divorce in 2017. And then I was invited to move with the kids in with my mom. Mm. So, and I had conversations with God about that because I wasn't sure what the best move would be. I was open to staying in Ohio or moving back. And so we ended up coming back here with the help of incredible people in both states that just, again, demonstrated the Father's heart for all of us, my kids, and everybody who heard something from God and were given the opportunity to, like, support us. And it's just a beautiful story, a separate stories. But so, you know, financially and the provision of resources, God was faithful about providing for us. I was kind of in a single mom position, and my own mom is a single mom, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just trying to figure out what the resources are going to look like and how we're gonna make everything work and pay our bills. God kind of put things in place for us to be able to do that. So that was a blessing. And then I met somebody and had gotten engaged, and that was about 3.5 years in, and it did not end well, and there was a lot of stuff going on at the end that was really challenging. We were walking through some of that as a couple with Barry and with the support of other community who, you know, were loving and encouraging. And it ended up closing, and the relationship came to a close there. And I was updating some family. This is right around Christmas. So it's like, well, unfortunately, I don't want to come to our first Christmas together since the pandemic. Like, I really look for, that's one of my favorite family gatherings is our Christmas gathering with various sides of the family. And we had to do it remotely. For the first time, I've never missed a Christmas with my family ever. I've flown in even when I was in Ohio. So that was discouraging that year. But so I was really happy to come together. And I'm like, okay, well, now I have this update about how we're not getting married and things did not go well. And I don't want to dump that on everyone for Christmas. So I tried to kind of just give that information out. And I had a chance to kind of catch people up and update them when they would check on me. And one of my family members, after kind of hearing some of the story, was then commented, like, your dad would have been proud of the way you handled. And so that was encouraging.
I wanted to also ask you, because I think sometime during that time, you took the 30-day challenge. And just for those listening that don't know, the 30-day challenge was something that Pastor Barry had said. For 30 days, every day, he wanted us to ask God how God sees us.
Right.
And so I wanted to ask you about that and what God said to you during that 30-day challenge. What stood out for you?
Yeah, so I am not a first adopter. I usually wait a couple rounds.
Okay.
Like, oh, that sounds great. I'll think about it. And then Barry would be like, so if you didn't do it last time, guess what? You guys get a chance to do it again. I highly recommend it. You know, it's eventually I was like, okay. So I did, and the very first day, you know, that I spent just kind of thinking, the phrase that came to me at that time was "sweet girl," which is more of a like a parental or a it's something you would hear from a mentor to somebody. It's a very affectionate, loving kind of a term. It's not usually a peer to peer, maybe. of, of a phrase. Yeah. And so I just felt, again, the Father's heart in that moment.
Yeah.
And all of the just different negative thoughts that I had been hearing. At this point in my walk, I know that the negative thoughts that I hear, you know, the criticisms or things that are demoralizing or feel like rejection or criticism, I know now to like look at God and say, what part of this is something that you want me to hear? Because some parts of it might be valid for whatever reason. So what parts of these things? So in my 13-year marriage, I spent time at the end of that practicing. Like, what parts of my marriage are things that I need to work on, even though I was resistant and, like, bitter and, you know, whatever I was feeling about the relationship. I'm like, but is any of this true? And is any of this stuff that you would like me to kind of work on? Mm-hmm. So I learned, I practice filtering that way. And so in this most recent relationship, when things started turning and I was having all these different thoughts and they, you know, different negative thoughts or things like whatever was going on in my head. And I was like, okay, God, what parts of this is stuff that you want that is true? You know, and then, you know, as a result of my previous relationship, I have some abandonment and some rejection issues. Mm-hmm. And some of those things were getting triggered again. Mm-hmm. And so to hear the first day of the 30-day challenge, the word sweet girl, that is just such a tender.
Yeah.
It's just such a tender, intimate phrase.
Yes.
And people don't say that to you unless, you know, there's a level of compassion and intimacy there. So that really reminded me and kind of confirmed, you know, this is how God sees me.
Yes, yes.
So
that was
the first of, you know, some various other moments in that time period that were very encouraging for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, Liz, you also told me that God also asked you to partner with Him, almost in a sense saying, put your trust in me. And so I wondered if you can talk about that.
So now we have this track record, you know, going where I've seen it ever since I was small. I've observed it. Yeah. And at this point, you know, basically, toward the end of my marriage, I hit this wall where I was like, I've learned something that changes everything that is terrible, and nobody can fix it. I can't even think of one person that I can call right now that will be able to comfort or fix anything, because this is not a fixable event. And then in that moment, I was also feeling like, why isn't God that person for me by now? You know, if I'm a believer and I say that I stand for God at a certain place, then why am I not immediately excited, or not excited, but like, okay, God, I need you. Like, why am I not finding that? So that says something about my relationship with Him is also broken in some way. So again, the end of my marriage also helped rebuild that aspect of my relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And so this time around, I was like, okay, God, I'm a pretty loyal and patient person, and I've seen you do redemptive things. I've seen you grow people, and I believe you can, and I have hope for that. However, I need your help, and I learned this from a coworker. Shout out to Jada in Cincinnati.
All right.
And she said, yeah, sometimes I don't always get it. I don't always get what God's saying. And so I just say, can you make it clear?
Okay.
As simple as that.
Yeah.
And so I was like, that's genius. Why don't I do that? Yeah. Like, we ask Him for all kinds of things, but I've never regularly said, God, I need it to be clear. I need you to make it even clearer.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty hard-headed and maybe it is really clear and I'm just like not willing to admit it.
Yeah.
But can you make it more clear? Mm-hmm. And God is really faithful about that as well. And just the way the situation evolved, it became a very clear answer. Mm. And at the end of it, I felt at peace about it and I felt freedom, which is rare when something ends that was really important or meaningful. I felt freedom there. It's sad, but it's like, okay, God released this for me because I wasn't able to do it myself.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, and as you were, as I was listening to your story, a verse came to mind, and so I just wanted to quote it. Psalms 37, 5 and 6 says, "Commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteousness shine like the dawn, and the justice of your cause like the noonday sun." And I just thought that was such a neat description of the putting your trust in the Lord and what he would do. So wanted to quote that. And also, you had an experience with your daughter Vivian when she was asked to talk about who she looks up to as being brave. And so I wondered if you can talk about what she said.
Yeah, so our Catalyst has been partnering with Michelle, I forget her last name, but
Okimura.
Uh-huh. Michelle Okimura, yeah. With Explicit Movement. And then, you know, Sakura Reese has created the Brave and Beautiful booklet, magazine.
Yes.
And one of our community and her daughter, Joey and Christina, decided that they would like to walk some of our young girls through this curriculum. And so Viv and her cousin Mimi and some of the other young middle school aged girls are participating in this. And so they had their first meeting a few weekends ago. And one of the introductory questions was, you know, what does bravery mean to you, or something like that? What's an example? Who do you know that kind of exemplifies that? So they invited all of the mothers to participate in the very first meeting. And then ongoing, they'll meet with the girls separately. Mm-hmm. And so they had a chance to kind of go around and share. And Viv, my youngest, she's come a long way. She was a little bit more of a later starter, as is often the case with the youngest, because my attention, Eve got all my one-on-one focus as the oldest child, and then, you know, by the time the third plus kid comes along, you're like, okay, well, you know, you're probably fine. Sometimes. So anyway, and so more recently she's come into being more articulate and just developing some really cool character. I mean, she's always been a cool character, but just the maturity.
Yeah.
And so I was actually pleasantly surprised by her thoughtful response. And, you know, she just talked about bravery. And then when they asked her who's an example of that, she said me. And I was like, oh, wow, you know. And she's just said, you know, just basically her observations watching me through, you know, the end of her parents being married and in this past relationship and just going to work every day. Things that I kind of take for granted. I mean, that's the work every day thing. That's more basic, but you know, just to hear her say that and to know that she's thinking that just goes back to what you said earlier, like they're watching.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if you're not sure if they're listening or if they care, but yeah. And so that was very moving for me to hear her acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't have to twist her arm or anything.
Yeah, and it'll forever be solidified in the pages of The Bold and the Beautiful as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
really
so awesome. Yeah, that is a blessing. Yeah. So, Liz, as we start to wrap up our time together, I wanted to ask you what words of advice or encouragement you could give to our listeners that might be going through a difficult patch or tough time in their lives. What would you say to them?
Well, the most important thing is that God sees you where you are. So if you feel like life is hard, and it doesn't look like it's going to get better. And whether you believe it'll get better right now, I mean, sometimes you just have your moments where, like, I don't feel like it's ever going to get better, yeah. or it might not, or it doesn't feel like it right now. I mean, you have these really discouraging moments, and God has space for us there.
Yes.
I mean, he promises to build a way, and that things are put together, and that he is doing things even if we don't see it or feel it, mm-hmm. for our good.
Yeah.
And also just that the story is not just about me and how I feel. It's other people and how it impacts them and how he can work through me or through them, mm-hmm. so that we could be a blessing to each other. Mm-hmm. So many just different layers of growth and blessing that he yes. has going on all at the same time.
Yes.
And just to trust that that's going on. So I think just to give a word of encouragement to people that are sitting in a season of challenge, that God sees you where you are, and mm-hmm. he's not mad at you. mm-hmm. And you could be really honest with God and say, I am mad. I'm mad at you, or I'm mad at this person, or this sucks. I mean, I feel like you can be, God already knows. He knows you. Yeah. He loves yeah. you where you're at. He knows why you think the way you mm-hmm. think, and mm-hmm. he knows the steps it's going to take you to yeah. get you through it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then just like I shared with you, my favorite verse during yes. a lot of these hard seasons, and I was really surprised that it's not a verse that I was familiar with previously, but the verse is Zephaniah, let me see, Zephaniah 3:17, and this was a verse as part of a activity, you know, that my Ohio church just had these different, like, things printed out and posted, and they're like, which one of these resonates with you? Spend some time okay. in this space.
Wow.
So they would set up these prayer experiences, and this verse popped out to me and hit me right in the middle of the face. So yeah. Zephaniah 3:17, the Lord your God is with you, the mighty warrior who saves. He will take great delight in you. In his love, he will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing.
Wow.
And
wow.
It just kind of, you know, resonated.
Yeah.
It's a challenging space, but God is rejoicing, and
yes.
he sees you where you are.
Yes.
So
yes.
just kind of hit all of those for me.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I would encourage others.
Yeah, that's so awesome. And you know, when you were sharing that, I also thought that, you know, because you said, tell God if you're upset, you know, tell him honestly how you are. And I thought, you know, not only does God see us where we're at, but he also sees what we can become and what we will become yeah. down the road, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So I think
because we don't know that with our kids. We're just kind of hopeful.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're like, I hope you turn out great. But he knows.
He knows, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Liz, as we start to, as we wrap up our time together, just first of all, I want to thank you so much for being here on Catalyst Stories and sharing your amazing journey with us and your journey with God as well. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'd love to lift up a prayer of thanksgiving for your testimony and your journey and for listeners as well. So yeah, let's pray. Father, thank you, Jesus, for the way that you've walked with Liz all these years, Lord, especially in 2022 and over the years, for the guidance of and words of wisdom from so many people. Lord, I just think of the support network that Liz talked about, not only here, but back in Ohio, and for Pastor Barry, and for all the answered prayers. So we just want to thank you for that. Thank you for showing Liz the desire to partner with you, that she could put her trust in you, Lord God, and help us also to put our trust in you no matter what the situation or circumstance. And again, I want to quote Psalm 37:5 and 6, commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteousness shine like the dawn, the justice of your cause like the noonday sun. It can be counted on. And Lord, thank you for the words from you directly to Liz of Sweet Girl. And I just think that's just like you to be our Abba Father and to speak those words. So thank you that those words from you to Liz will forever be etched in her mind. And Lord, thank you also that I just want to also thank you, Father God, for the way that you vindicated Liz's dad and watched over her entire family during that difficult time. And I pray that you'd help us to rely on your justice. And again, we're reminded of Psalm 17:2 that says, "Let my vindication come from you. May your eyes see what is right." And Lord, thank you for giving Liz the courage to hang in there for her children during the difficult times, to get the validation that she got from Vivian and through you, Lord. And just want to end by quoting 1 Corinthians 16:13 in the New King James Version, to watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, and be strong. And so thank you for how you've helped Liz, and not only that, but that her daughter Vivian can also acknowledge and validate that in Liz as well. And now, Jesus, may you use these testimonies in Liz's life to inspire all of us to become all that you created and called us to be in Christ Jesus. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, thanks, Liz. And that's it for today's episode of Catalyst Stories. Until next time, take the time to reflect on and share your God-given testimonies and see how God uses you to become a catalyst of encouragement and inspiration to others. God bless.